Good morning, and welcome to the Albany Report. I'm your host, former State Senator Cecilia Kacik, and today we're going to be talking about corruption in Albany. I think given the ongoing trial that our sitting former Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos and his son Adam Skelos are, their trial is ongoing. We've seen the former Assembly Speaker, Sheldon Silver, was found guilty last week on all seven charges of fraud, theft of honest services, bribery, and lying about it. So he was found guilty. So I think this sent shockwaves through Albany, and we will be talking about what can we do about it with our guests today, which I hope Skype in. I haven't heard from them yet. But joining us, hopefully in just a moment or two, will be Susan Lerner from Common Cause. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Zephyr Teachout, who ran for governor, for the office of governor in 2014, and has written a book called Corruption in America, and is a professor at Fordham Law School. She'll be joining us to talk about what she thinks needs to be done to fix our state government in Albany. But right now, while we're waiting for Susan Lerner to Skype in, I want to let folks know that we'd like to hear from you, our listeners. We often say, please give us a call and let us know what you think. So here's an opportunity to weigh in and let us know what you think about the corruption scandals, the ongoing trials, and how we can do something about it. And what are your ideas? And are you concerned? Let's hear from you. So you can call in. You don't have to wait till later. You can call in anytime here in the studio. The number is 518-828-0290. Because it's really important that you do weigh in. And one of the things that happened shortly after Sheldon Silver, the former Speaker of the Assembly, was found guilty on corruption is he filed to receive his retirement from the state of New York, which is paid by the taxpayers. And that is one of the pieces of legislation that was supposedly supposed to be fixed by the Senate and the Assembly and signed by the governor last session. And it ended up not getting done. So not only was the Speaker of the Assembly found guilty of corruption, he's now collecting his pension. And we needed to change the state constitution so that if people who are sitting legislators are found guilty of corruption, they shouldn't get their pension. But we have to pass a law, and that then has to go to the voters for approval because we have to change something in the state constitution. So that didn't happen last session. And so here we sit having a very prominent leader found guilty of corruption is now collecting a pension. So there are things the legislature can and should be doing. There's things the governor can and should be doing. And I think it would behoove the public that, you know, that their legislators and the governor know we expect them to make some changes. So while we're waiting for Susan Lerner to Skype in, I think I'm going to take a break and give us a chance to get her on the phone. And I'm going to need to do a little music interlude right here. You want to play that? So Neva has suggested we play Sinead O'Connor, Fire on Babylon. So this is Neva's pick. So here we go.
To start the show off, one of Ireland's greatest performers and artists, ladies and gentlemen, got a new album, Universal Mother. She's now going to be doing a Fire on Babylon. Please welcome Sinead O'Connor.
This should be played at high volume, preferably in a residential area. This should be played. high volume, preferably in a residential area. This should be played at high volume, preferably in a residential area.
She took my father from my home. Took my sister and brothers. Oh, I watched her torturing my child.
Sinead O'Connor, Fire on Babylon, kind of giving me the sense that there's fire in Albany, and we're finally saying, hey, there's a fire on in Albany, and it's called Corruption, and we need government to work for the people. And one of those organizations that do that is Common Cause. And on the phone is Susan Lerner. And Susan Lerner is from Common Cause. Susan, can you hear me? Susan has joined us by phone, and Common Cause is one of those good government groups that works on issues to make democracy work, to make government work better for the people. So, Susan, why don't you tell us about Common Cause and the work that your organization does, and we'll start with that.
Sure. So Common Cause was founded in the 70s by John Gardner, who was a Republican who served in Lyndon Johnson's cabinet. He was the Secretary of HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, for Johnson. And his realization was that everybody is organized in the halls of power but the people. And Common Cause was founded to be the people's voice in legislatures, in Congress initially, and then legislatures around the country. So we have over 400,000 members. We have a presence in 32 states. And we are known in the state houses where we are active as advocates, as you said, for good government. Our tagline is holding power accountable. And we've been involved in virtually all of the campaign finance and ethics reforms that have taken place in this country in the last 40 years. at the congressional level and at state houses around the country. And here in New York, we're active in a number of different fronts. We're strong advocates for fair elections, a system of reforming our campaign finance program so that people who are everyday citizens would be able to run with a small dollar matching fund, and closing up other problems in our campaign finance system. We're advocates for strong and effective ethics guidance and enforcement. We believe the legislature should be full-time with no outside income. And we work on redistricting and on media and democracy issues as well.
So you've been working in New York for a while now.
Yes, Common Cause has been here in New York since the 70s. We helped write the original Freedom of Information law, and I've been in my position for about 8 years now.
Great. Well, so you've been around. You've seen how Albany works. You've tried to get Albany to work better and be more attuned to the needs of the public rather than special interests and the wealthy and the people who get involved in the pay-to-play system. Have you been surprised by anything that's come out in the corruption trials so far and the conviction of former Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver?
Well, I think as good government advocates, we always hope for the best. We see a lot of the things that happen behind the scenes, and it's always disappointing to see our worst suspicions confirmed. But what was really surprising and heartening in the trial, actually, was the way in which the final juror made her decision to decide that Shelley Silver was guilty of self-dealing and denying the public the fair value of his services. And what changed her mind, because your listeners may not be aware that from the very beginning, early on in the jury deliberations, it became clear that there was one juror who wasn't sure. She sent a note to the judge on the first day of deliberation saying she wanted to go home. She was very anxious. It seemed as if she had a different opinion from everybody else,
right.
And could she be excused? And the judge said, no, you cannot be excused. You know, everybody should behave like adults and respectfully and work out, the differences of how people are interpreting the evidence. They went back to work, and ultimately, within a relatively short time, about 2.5 days, they found Sheldon Silver guilty on all 7 counts. And reporters talked to members of the jury afterwards, and one person identified herself as the juror who had wanted to go home on the first day. And reporters asked her, well, what made you decide that he was guilty? And she said, well, I listened to all of the evidence, we went over everything in the jury room, and then I looked at Silver's disclosure forms. Now, back in 2010, there was an effort to pass significant ethics reform, and we at Common Cause felt that it fell short, and we urged Governor Patterson to veto that bill,
mm-hmm.
which he did, because we thought we could get a stronger bill and better disclosures. So Andrew Cuomo came in, and in 2011 and 2012 actually did push through a somewhat stronger, still not perfect, but somewhat stronger ethics reform bill. And that bill, for the first time, required more detailed accounting of outside income by legislators, and for the first time required that those forms be placed on the internet and people have access to them. Before then, you have to ask, and before you were allowed to look at anybody's forms, the legislator was notified that somebody wanted to look at his or her outside income, and you could be stopped. So the juror said she went and looked at Sheldon Silver's disclosure forms, and when she saw that some of his outside income that came from fees that Glenwood Management paid to a small real estate firm in New York City were not on his disclosure forms, she concluded he knew he was doing something wrong, that he had something to hide, and she became the 12th vote for conviction. So there are times when we do make a difference, and that was good to see. Even though we need bigger and bolder change, even incremental change can help. And in this instance, it was the disclosure statement which brought Shelley Silver down.
So we can't go to the courts, though, every time. We need to get rid of someone who's not doing
absolutely
the job.
How do we change
this system so that it makes sure that we have the ability to ensure that our government is working for us and not people who are gaming the system?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. First of all, I believe, as I said earlier, that the legislature should be full-time.
Right.
They should get a hike in pay, and they should be barred from outside earned income, or either significant restrictions the way you have at the congressional level. So that's step one. Take that conflict off the table.
Let's talk about about that before we go through the whole list.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure your legislature works for you, the public, rather than someone else. I mean, when you think about it, this is common sense. You want legislators working for you. There shouldn't be this conflict for your time and energy and focus. Because if you're working for someone else, you're not working for me, essentially.
Exactly. I mean, last year we joined in on a report the three groups put out called Serving Two Masters. It's an inherent conflict. And in actuality, I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that our elected officials really are such great multitaskers that they're paying enough attention to whatever job they have for outside income and the demands of oversight of a state government with a budget of $150 billion, an economy and a society and population much more diverse than many countries around the world. So we expect a lot of our legislators. And I think if you asked everyday New Yorkers, would it be okay with you if you called to meet with your state senator or your state assembly member, or you asked them to come to an important ceremony in your community and you were told, no, he doesn't work for you on that day. That's the day he or she works at their outside job. I don't think people expect to be told that.
Well, and let's be clear.
I don't think we're being honest with ourselves.
And those outside jobs, given what we're learning from the trials, are often no-show jobs.
Yeah,
it's
there's
just,
that
you're
problem.
Just, you really are doing nothing, and you're getting money, and because we allow this type of employment to work. When I was a senator, you know, there was no doing anything else, and even as a farmer, I had a little outside income because I was earning some money off of the farm, and I didn't stop farming, but I made sure that my husband dealt with anything to do with the farming because I could do nothing else, and I didn't want to do anything else. And as a senator, I spent 7 days a week working in that role. To me, to say that these jobs really are part-time is ridiculous.
I think that's exactly right, and that's why I talked about the expectations of constituents that their elected representatives are going to be available and active in the community as elected representatives. And the truth of the matter is, Cece, that the report that we issued last year with NYPERG and Reinvent Albany, in 2014 disclosure statement showed that more than two-thirds of the legislature didn't have significant outside income. They are actually working full-time for the people. We're just shortchanging them in terms of the salary, and we're allowing a very small number of primarily leaders in both houses who have significant outside income, primarily through law practices, often no-show type jobs, to dominate this discussion and to keep the public from getting the full value of the services of the people that they elect to represent them.
All right, so that's one recommendation. No outside income because you only have one job and you should get a little bit more for the job that you're doing, and that way you don't feel like you have to change your current situation. But I think it's difficult, especially in the Senate, because you have so many people who've been there so long that are, you know, this is the way it is, and for them to change. And I think has the current leader of the Senate, John Flanagan, has already said that he doesn't support the lack of outside income. Is that correct?
He has said that he doesn't believe in a full-time legislature because he believes that nurses and construction workers and so forth should be legislators while they're also doing those inflexible outside jobs.
It's one thing to have another job before you become a legislator, but right. to seriously continue in that job is just absurd, in my opinion.
It is absurd, and it's a dodge, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is, because it isn't a full-time legislature, because the salary hasn't risen in over a decade, it makes it much harder for people who aren't wealthy or lawyers or independent business people to run for office. So you don't have teachers, nurses, and construction workers who are up there in Albany sharing their life experience and helping to shape our laws based on a very different set of experiences. But that leads me to the second issue, mm-hmm. which we believe needs to be changed, and that's limiting the influence of dark money campaign contributions and government spending that takes place in the shadows, basically dealing not only with the outside income but the money problem, and part of that would be providing public funding for election campaigns so that farmers, nurses, teachers, construction workers who don't have independent outside incomes could actually be able to run for office relying on their constituents, and then once they got to Albany, they would be able to work full-time for the people. So that's part of the problem. But we've got two other aspects that are glaring in the money and politics aspect. One is what we call the LLC loophole, the limited liability company loophole, which is the ability of specific types of business entities to contribute campaign dollars as if they were individuals, as if they were humans and not companies. Corporations under our campaign finance law are limited to $5,000 a year, but because of a bad interpretation by a board of elections, the LLCs are treated as if they were humans, and they can give up to $160,000 a year.
But they are controlled by someone. They're
Absolutely.
Not set up by themselves. They are set up by a person who is controlling them. And in the real estate industry, often, you know, you set up an LLC for each separate building so you can keep track of the books that way. And
it's a legitimate way to conduct your business, but that means that a large real estate developer will have anywhere from 40 to 50 or more LLCs legitimately in his or her portfolio. And that means each one of them can give up to $160,000 a year, which is how you end up with the situation that Glenwood Management, a large real estate holding company in New York City, which is front and center in both the Silver and Skelos trials, is able to give Governor Cuomo over $1 million in one particular year and able to give close to that amount to the campaign committees in both houses of the legislature.
Right. And let's talk about trying to close this loophole. This loophole has been around for quite a few years, and because of it, certain people like Leonard Litwin and Glenwood Management have undue influence, much more influence in the political process than the typical voter or the public, and then their issues get addressed. And that came out in the Sheldon Silver trial, where it was clear he was getting something from this process, and that's why he was involved. And their influence is also coming out in the Dean Skelos trial. The failure to close this loophole rests with our legislators. This past session, the Assembly passed legislation that would close it. The governor has said he would support closing it. The state Senate Republicans refused to even give it a vote in committee by moving the bill to another committee. Essentially, they're not even following their own rules.
Right.
So that they don't have to take a vote on it.
Correct, because they know how toxic this issue is. They know their constituents hate the idea that LLCs are treated differently and that companies can then rack up over $1 million in campaign contributions. They're scared of this issue, and so they've bottled it up. I don't think that they're going to be able to avoid it indefinitely.
But how do you get it to the floor?
Well, I think, first of all, we've got to keep the pressure on. We, being the public, not just the good government groups, have to let their legislators know that this is not okay. There's a lawsuit which is pending. It's going to be argued later this this month, pending in Greene County, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Now, who's bringing the lawsuit, and what is the lawsuit about?
So the lawsuit is brought by the Brennan Center and two other individuals, who one Democrat and one Republican. It's bipartisan in its approach, and it attacks the LLC loophole as a misinterpretation of our campaign finance laws. And the suit is against the Board of Elections, because the Board of Elections is the body which improperly interpreted the law. Interestingly enough, the Senate Republicans have chosen to intervene as defendants in the lawsuit. This entire situation could be changed overnight if the Senate Republicans were to instruct the Republican representatives on the Board of Elections to vote to close the loophole. The Democrats on the board already moved to try and close loophole. And they said they're willing to do that. And the Republicans said, oh, the law isn't clear. So this could close tomorrow. It doesn't have to go to a lawsuit, and it doesn't have to go to the legislature. But it looks as if it's going to have to go both routes. But I believe that the pressure is ramping up. I think the pressure coming out of the Silver trial is escalating. And, of course, we need to see what happens with the trial of former Senate Majority Leader and President Pro Tem of the State Senate, Dean Skelos. And I believe that if Skelos is found guilty, then there's going to be very different pressure on the Senate, which is already feeling the pressure. So we're working with senators, and we're also working with our members, so we're constituents in important districts where you have committee chairs who've bottled up the bill, and also where the leadership is found. And I believe that we can put on pressure, because I don't think that the Senate Republicans can simply stand and shrug their shoulders at the hurricane level winds that are building coming out of the Silver and Skelos trial.
Well, let's talk about the legislature and where this legislation is at, because this is a two-year cycle, so the legislation does not have to get reintroduced again. So it's still in the Elections Committee. The chair is...
Well, no, actually, it's not.
Oh, that's right. It was moved to the Corporations Committee.
It was moved to the Corporations Committee, and that's why our members in Senator Ranzenhofer's district in the spring let him know that they wanted to see it move. So I think, unlike the situation last year where the parliamentary procedures to try and move it were attempted at the very end of the session, I think that there will be a much more concerted effort from the very beginning of the session, and I think it will be much harder for the Republicans to simply bottle it up.
Well, I want to just point out to our listeners, because we have two representatives on this election committee in the Senate who represent the WGXC listening area, and that's George Amador and Kathy Marchione, and they both are on the Elections Committee, and both did not take a position on the LLC loophole. Senator Amador didn't even vote on it in committee, and Senator Marchione voted to allow it to go to another committee. So they both had an opportunity to take a strong stand and say, let's close the loophole because it's ripe for corruption and allows people with a lot of money to have undue influence, and they both did not do that when they had the chance to. And I think people should know, and that's something that they should talk to their legislator about. Because if
absolutely,
if
absolutely.
The legislators are allowing, you know, this to be bottled up, they're supporting the status quo and the current system of pay to play.
Look, Cece, the truth of the matter is that there are advocates and there are concerned citizens and journalists like yourself. We talk about these issues all the time. But what we hear from some legislators is, well, my voters don't care about this. My constituents don't talk to me about this. This is, I think, a very important moment where we have more leverage than ever before to try and affect change. But advocacy groups and editorial boards cannot do it alone. This is an opportunity for the public to step up and communicate.
And
I
think
one of
the things that the trials is doing is educating the public so that we're realizing this is what's going on in Albany at the behest of our legislators and our governor, because they're allowing it to happen. And they know this is happening. This is not a mystery to people who are, you know, legislative representatives. They know this is going on. And that, to me, is just inexcusable. You've got to change the system. They will not change the system because they need the money that this system provides to run campaigns. So unless they hear from the voters and feel more concerned about how the voters react to it, and you're right, voters don't care, but they don't know what's going on.
I do think voters care. I think the problem is something different. I think voters care, but voters feel powerless. I think people are disgusted, and when they're disgusted, they tend to turn off. We're past the time for disgust. It's time for anger, and anger leads to action. The only way we've ever gotten significant reforms through, and as I said at Common Cause, we've gotten them through at Congress and around the country, is when people got angry and demanded change. Watergate is a perfect example. And that, I think, is the kind of sustained pressure and attention which we need from every concerned New Yorker, not just, oh, my God, they're corrupt. We knew they were corrupt. There's nothing we can do. We can do something about it. We can get it to change. But we're the ones who have to push them because, as you've said, internally, you know, they think insiders in Albany think the system works for them and it makes sense. And one thing the Sheldon Silver trial really showed very, very well is how out of touch and how removed from reality people who've been in the Albany system for too long become. And they don't see how bad it is. They don't understand, or they've convinced themselves that they aren't doing anything wrong. And that's why the jury is such a strong wake-up call, and a wake-up call has to come from the voters as well. It's not us, and we're pushing.
And in the Sheldon Silver defense, the defense said, well, this is the way Albany works. This is the way business gets done. And that was their defense. And which is, you know, galling and appalling to hear that in public. What is the governor's role in all of this? I mean, one of the things that I think the governor can do, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the governor can call a special session. Clearly, you know, with the holidays coming, they're not going to call a special session.
They're not going to call a special session. But
he could call a special session next year at any time, even while they're in session, and put an agenda on the floor in the Senate and force a vote on a bill the LLC loophole closure bill, right?
Right. He doesn't have to cast around for an agenda, actually. Attorney General Schneiderman has a fairly comprehensive reform package that we at Common Cause and other good government groups have endorsed. So it's really a question of political will. The governor, who has in the past said that he's a strong proponent of reform and claims that he's passed the most significant ethics reforms historically here in New York than anybody has, we're waiting for him to understand how angry the public is. And yes, as I said, the 2012 ethics bill did make some helpful changes. But the truth of the matter is saying that this is the most anybody's done in New York in ethics is a very, very low bar.
Yeah, that's not saying much by saying that these are the strongest ethics laws in the history of New York State. That's not saying much.
Yeah, so it's time. We definitely need to be hearing from the governor, and I think it's time for him to step up to the plate. Some of the things that we're proposing would impact the governor as well. So, for instance, we believe that it's way past time to ensure that to the extent that there are discretionary funds in the budget, and right now there's over $2 billion of economic development money larded in different places throughout the budget that the governor has major influence over. Although we don't have direct member items anymore, there are still ways in which legislators are able on their say-so alone to get money to projects or people that they want to do favors for. That ought to stop. There needs to be complete transparency, and there need to be controls on any discretionary money that's given out. And that was a major problem in the Silver trial, and it's come up also in the Skelos trial.
Well, absolutely. They're having pots of money that you can dole out is just, again, part of the pay-to-play system, and you reward your friends and punish your enemies.
Indeed.
And it's just, this is not the way we need to deal with our public policy and the issues that are screaming for attention, the infrastructure concerns, yeah. You know, making sure that the bridges are safe. And
well, and that if that money is going to go for infrastructure, as it should, that it is the projects are chosen on some objective basis, not on political favoritism and rewards or punishments.
Right.
This is way too important.
Right. We should be making decisions.
We do need economic development. We do need infrastructure investment, but it's got to be done on some basis other than he's my crony, this one gets a favor from me, that one voted against me on something, I'm not giving his people any money.
Right. I mean, decisions should be made on this is the best use of our taxpayer dollars for our citizens. And we combine our money because we need to take care of roads and bridges. We need a strong education system. We need a good police force. We need things that support our society. And when people take our money and do it for other gains, it's really disturbing. So I think people should be angry. But I want to get back to the governor because he has said, oh, I don't want to, you know, there's no appetite from the legislature to make changes. But
that is so wrong. First of all, I mean, when I talk to members of the legislature, there's a great appetite to get things done. There's no appetite among the leadership of the Senate, but that's not the entire legislature.
So when he says, I'm not going to push them to put this on the floor because it's not going to pass, it's that to me is a cop-out, and he's just covering up for them, and they're covering for him because he's benefiting as well. He, as we have seen, because this is just closed, Glenwood Management and Leonard Litwin, who runs Glenwood Management, have given millions of dollars to the governor in his campaign accounts. So he's benefiting from the system as well. So when they point at each other and say, it's not me, it darn well is you. And even if you put the bill on the floor, you force the members to take a vote. So if it goes down, you've got them on the record, then you know who is really supporting the current pay-to-play system and who wants it to change. And that public scrutiny will probably mean that they will vote it through. They will support it.
Yeah,
but when
that's right. That's why they're trying to bottle things up and not have them come to the floor. We also need to be tightening up our ethics oversight so that this kind of favoritism isn't business as usual, and we don't have to wait for the federal prosecutor to come in and clean up the problem. And that really would require that the Joint Commission on Public Ethics has to be strengthened. Its voting rules have to be regularized so that a minority can't stop investigations.
Can you have
and
an entity
to be made more independent?
Can you have an entity like that set up so that they have an oversight committee from outside of government so that the leadership and the governor don't control it?
Yeah, absolutely you could. There's no question that it's possible to do that. It's really there are various different ways of choosing people who serve on these kinds of commissions, but more important is the expectation of the people appointing the folks on the commission. And if the expectation is, we're picking you because we know that you have a reputation for integrity and independence, and we expect you to do your job, and we're not going to be calling you every other week to tell you what we like and what we don't like, and we're not calling you on the carpet for the things that you do,
right,
then people will behave that way, according, with independence.
And given a separate budget that they control. And,
correct.
You know, one of the things that was clear to me when I did serve in the Senate and I was on the elections committee, that we have a board of elections that doesn't have the ability to enforce wrongdoing and investigate problems. Do you have suggestions for the Board of Elections and the current system that we see there to change?
Yes, we've had an incremental step which is taken. An enforcement council was named. They have more autonomy in the more autonomy to enforce than the board had previously. And there is a set budget for that position. But the problem is that it isn't really completely independent, and we're seeing too much control from the governor, and that's the big challenge in these systems. The legislature doesn't want to set up an independent oversight in the Board of Elections or in ethics because they're afraid that it will come back at them. And the governor, unfortunately, has shown that he's not really willing to have it be independent of him. So we do have a bit of a problem, but it could be set up. It doesn't have to be within the Board of Elections. It could be independent, the way the New York City Campaign Finance Board is an independent entity that is charged with being independent and being thorough in protecting the New York City small donor matching fund campaign finance system. There are various ways to do this. It is really that here in New York, we're not seeing a lot of creativity, let me put it that way.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. Well, we did hear from Zephyr Teachout. She is stuck on a train and is not going to be able to Skype in with us on today's show. So we will have her on a later show. I just wanted to give our listeners a heads up on that. So I'm going to continue to talk to you, Susan, if that's okay. And we just have a few more minutes left in our hour, and this, I think, has been very helpful to folks. What do you want to see come January from the governor in his State of the State address? Do you think he's going to bring this up and focus on it?
Well, I think that he should. I think he absolutely should. I think it would be a glaring omission if this were not an important part of his State of the State. And, you know, the governor has just announced that he is going to combine, as he did last year, because of the sad death of his father, he's combining the State of the State and the release of the executive budget into one presentation.
He's doing that again?
He's doing that again, only he's doing it a bit earlier in the month. He's doing it on January 13th. We would like to see a strong statement about comprehensive ethics reform. We'd like to see him propose real changes to JACOB so that it is independent. We'd like to see its budget line go up. We would like to see strengthening of enforcement at the Board of Elections level. And we would like to see him also make significant budgetary commitments to reforming our actual election administration for election technology and early voting.
Now, have the good government groups gotten together and conveyed this to the governor and his people?
Well, we back in November, we sent the governor and both leaders of the legislature our proposals for comprehensive ethics reform. And the groups that work on election administration have also communicated with the governor's office and requested that there be a budget line for modernizing our elections.
And so I don't agree with the having the State of the State combined with the budget. The budget is this huge, massive document, and that in and of itself, I think, needs its own discussion. And the State of the State was done on the very first day of the legislative session. And
right.
You kind of laid out your priorities and why these are your priorities and get people on board. When you combine it with the budget, people are going to be so interested in looking at, you know, that set, these different sections of the budget and where's my program, et cetera.
Well, here's another problem with doing it this way, is that it basically strips, or what it does is it improperly forces policy issues into the budget,
right?
Which is a increasing problem that we have seen over the last several sessions, where the governor isn't willing to really do the difficult work of bringing the legislature around on some of his more ambitious policy issues. So instead, he tries to force all of them into the budget.
Which I think is not appropriate, frankly.
It is not appropriate according to the way in which our system is set up. And it's not a good way to set policy because it accelerates, if anything, it exaggerates the three men in a room problem.
Well, and the governor has much more power over the budget than the legislature.
Yes.
And they are held under the gun. You do it my way or we shut down government.
Right.
That, and we've saw what happened last year when he pushed much more education policy issues in the budget than we've seen in the past. And I think even now people are saying, well, it's not what we really wanted to do, and it's not the way to do good policy, is
no,
to be under a threat of well, we're not going to fund education. I mean, that is bullying tactics,
Not good government. It's negotiating. It's strong-arm tactics behind closed doors. It's not a thoughtful evolution of policy. And the whole basis on which our system is supposed to run is that the legislature is supposed to legislate. They're supposed to consider things in a objective and thoughtful way and develop a consensus among the different members and the different viewpoints in the legislature. One of the problems with our legislature is it doesn't do that as effectively as some others. But forcing policy issues through the budget, it takes an already bad process and makes it significantly worse. And it takes a already imbalanced, super strong governor system, and really, I think, exaggerates the worst parts of it.
Well, before I let you go, Susan, you mentioned another area of work that Common Cause, your organization works on is fair elections. 2016 is an election year for the congressional and Senate and Assembly seats. What would you like to see in the area of elections, and how can we get more people involved in the electoral process?
Well, you know, what we'd like to see is many more public debates. Ultimately, what we're working for is to provide public funding of elections so that more people who aren't independently wealthy or have wealthy friends are able to actually run for office and win. Community members, which the current President Pro Tem of the Senate claims he wants to see more of in the legislature.
Sorry, we've got a train going by and the building is shaking.
Yep, we can hear it.
It's community radio. And in our community, we have a train.
Well, trains are good. We like trains. We're working to bring early voting to New York State so that it is easier and more convenient for working people to be able to cast their ballots.
I think that makes so much sense. If you're working or you're a mom or dad taking care of the kids, you know, sometimes it's not convenient to vote on that one day. So early voting means you can vote at your convenience on a few days before, a week before, however it's set up. But that, to me,
right,
would help get more people to the polls.
It definitely makes it easier for people to vote. It's also a very rational response to the kind of unfortunate weather-related emergencies that we've had.
And we've had
several
them.
Times in the recent past around our general election.
Yep.
What we found in other states and talking to election officials around the state is that there's a big concern that early voting becomes yet another unfunded mandate from the state to the counties, because the counties have to bear the cost. In some other states, Maryland's a good example, the governor, really wanting to see early voting adopted, put money in his budget for the first year or two additional expense to the counties of early voting. And on that basis, he was able to negotiate with the legislature and get them to adopt early voting, and the counties weren't crying about the additional cost because it was taken care of in the state budget. I think that's something which should be done here in New York, and we think the governor should step up and place a reasonable amount of money in the budget so that the state would cover about half of the cost, and that would ameliorate, I think, a lot of the concerns that we see at the Board of Elections, mm-hmm. the County Board of Elections level.
Right.
Because one thing we found, and we actually released a report last year with this title, is that people love it. Any place that has early voting, it's very difficult to take it away because election administrators and the people from all political perspectives really, really like it. And they let their elected officials know and their election administrators know, hey, this is great. This works for us. And here in New York, we are way, way behind a lot of the rest of the country in how we run our elections. We could do a lot better.
So you're waiting for the governor to come out in support of proposals like this. Is there any legislation addressing that?
Yes. And this, the Assembly definitely is working on early voting. There's a new bill which has been introduced that encapsulates some of the best thinking on how to set up an early voting system. There was a bill earlier, but it was very inflexible, and it required a set number of early voting places in each and every county, and that just doesn't make any sense. You need some counties are going to need relatively few early voting locations, and other counties are going to need more. So a one-size-fits-all is not going to work, and the bill that has been introduced in the Assembly has flexibility for the counties to determine for themselves. So if we have that bill and some money in the budget for early voting expenses, I think we'd be able to get it done and done well.
Well, and we have representatives here in the WGXC listening area who are on the Elections Committee in the Senate, because clearly the Senate is the hurdle, and that's Senator George Amador and Senator Kathy Marchione, both on the Elections Committee, and it's chaired by Richard Funk from Rochester.
Funky, sorry.
And he was a freshman new senator in the past election. So you have young senators that, you know, should be involved in this. So if this is something you want to talk to your legislator about, it's imperative that you do. So we are wrapping up. Susan, I can't believe the entire hour has gone by. There's so much to talk about in the area of corruption, election reform, and good government. I can't thank you enough for spending so much time with us here in the studio. And I hope we will have you back again, you know, after the State of the State and budget presentation, and we can see where we're at on these issues. And on behalf of our listeners, thank you for participating not only on today's show, but for doing the work that you're doing. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye-bye. And we're going to end our show with a music selection.
I don't think I'm on the radio anymore. You cut me off. Okay, so I thought I was off the radio. It just sounded different. Sorry about that. So we're going to hear a music selection as we end our show, and I'll be back in 2 weeks, hopefully with Zephyr Teachout. And we're going to hear So Much Trouble in the World by Bob Marley and the Walkers. I'm sorry. I don't have my glasses on. The Wailers, Bob Marley and the Wailers. So Much Trouble in the World. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
My eyes this morning. Talking.